Claire, and you're listening to the Mother Love Podcast, a show where we talk about the journey of parenting. This is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy and delightful little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all, celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and courage. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love.
Hey everyone, just want to give a bit of a heads up before we enter into this conversation with Lisa Croak. She shares her story, and within her story are pieces that are a little bit hard to hear and can be intense and a little distressing. So I encourage everyone to listen if they can, build extra space and support and rest into your day today. And please know that Lisa leaves us with so much hope and inspiration for survivors and the road that lies ahead for them should they reach out and get help. So if you need support in the form of a conversation with someone who knows a lot about this, please call the Friendship Center. It is free. The calls are answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and all the information is kept completely confidential and can be totally anonymous if you wish. Even if you're not in Helena, even if you're not in any sort of a crisis situation, even if you just have questions to help you understand this issue more deeply, give them a call, 406-442-6800.
I am beyond honored to be here with you, Lisa, because just your story is so incredible, and we haven't yet been able to speak to someone who has been through what you've been through. And, you know, just a note that last week's episode is an interview with the Friendship Center, and the Friendship Center is a wonderful resource that exists here in Helena, Montana, for victims of domestic violence and domestic abuse and interpersonal violence and, you know, just anyone who's going through anything that has to do with that and has questions, they're amazing. So this is sort of a part two of that to that episode, kind of a sequel. And we really felt like it was important to speak with you because you have your own personal lived experience of having gone through this. So we're not just sharing the resource, but also really bringing to light what this is like in case people don't know that it's happening right under their own nose or that they're living in a relationship that is destructive and harmful in this way. So welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me and allowing me to tell my story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I just always really kind of like to, before we dive into the past, I always kind of like to just start with the present and let our guests get to know a little bit more about who you are in your modern day life and existence. And so will you just give us a snapshot of like what a typical day looks like for you these days, you know, setting characters? You can tell us a little bit about what you do for work and just give us a glimpse into your life.
Thanks for asking. Yep, I currently live on the East Coast, so I am ahead of you in time. So my day starts a little bit before yours does. I currently I'm a contractor and a consultant, and I am also a life coach. I am a coach that empowers women and empowers survivors to thrive.
So basically, you have a coaching business now where you use your superpowers as a survivor to help other survivors tap into their superpowers. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I am recently married. And so that is a wonderful part of my day. Our kids are grown. So we have four together that are all scattered throughout the country. So they don't live with us or near us. And I have nieces and nephews that are wonderful part of my life. I love being an auntie, and our parents live close by. So within the you know, within 2 or 3 hours of us. So we get to see them often. So we are just rich with family and taking care of ourselves and enjoying kind of this second season of life when our kids are out of the nest and we get to have some fun. So love to hike, love to travel, and love to just really have a life that is focused on taking care of ourselves really well, being calm, being peaceful, and then being of service to others on their journeys where they want to go.
Yeah, my goodness. It must feel so... This is the thing about gratitude, right? Is there's so much gratitude that exists when you have gained things and welcomed things into your life that for so long maybe didn't seem possible or reasonable, you know, and we'll know more about this as you share your story. But when you talk about like your peaceful mornings and things like that, like I know more of your background. And so I know how incredibly different that is from what you were used to for so many years. And so I just love thinking about that. Thanks. Like, are you, I'm curious about like the little things, like, are you a coffee or person or a tea person when you get up in the morning?
I love coffee. I have one cup of coffee. And we currently have a home that has a big back porch. And so the weather is starting to be nice. And so the birds are out. And so we go to the gym in the morning or we'll wake up and we'll just go outside and just sip the coffee where it's just a little bit cold, but a little bit warm and hear the just soak all that in. But my cup of coffee is my wonderful ritual in the morning. I have more than one. I get a little jittery, but just ease into the day that way is just wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Nice. And then I'm just curious, you know, I've spent no time at all on the East Coast. So what is it that you love about living on the East Coast? And what is it that you notice that you really miss about Montana?
What do I love about the East Coast? My family and diversity.
Yeah.
Access to big cities, access to different people and different cultures and the way they think. And you can get through 5 states in a day, you know, out west, you're driving and driving and driving and driving. I miss the mountains. They ground me. I miss, I used to hike Mount Helena on a regular basis. I loved having that out the back door. I love the crispness of the air. I love how when it chills and it's just, you can bundle up and be warm, but here it's more damp. So it kind of hurts your bones. And I miss the big sky and I miss the rhythm of life. The rhythm of life in Montana is just beautiful. It's like you shut down, you go home, you do your thing. On the East Coast, it's very driven. What are you doing next? What are you doing with your free time? What are your extra hours filled with? And so it's really hard to be intentional about creating space for calm and downtime and really protecting that peace. I found it much easier in Montana to plug into that just by looking out the window. You have all that gorgeousness there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. And how much of your time are you devoted right now to your coaching business? I know that that's somewhat of a new development.
Yeah.
So will you share a little more about that piece?
Yeah. So I have this opportunity to be here and I've got some speaking engagements, but I am really launching that. I started last year. I have a coaching role at work. And so I do a career work there, career coach. But my heart's desire is really building this business where I am empowering specifically domestic violence survivors to move from surviving to thriving. So we have superpowers. And a lot of times when you come out of being a victim and kind of you're stable, you're not in crisis anymore. You know what you're dealing with. You've kind of settled. You can sometimes get stuck there. And I think with the baggage that we carry as survivors, anxiety, depression, PTSD, CPTSD, autoimmune stuff that can come up for us, we forget what we've been through.
Yeah.
take on these labels and we really still have the tapes of our abusers in our minds.
Yeah.
If we can just pivot that story and reframe it and just recognize what we have been through and what we've survived, and we can just make that switch and be reminded and empowered of what we went through and what we stood up to and how we are still standing, we can embrace thriving.
Yes.
It is possible and it is exciting, and there is joy to be found, and there is peace and calm, and there is life beyond what we've known. And I am excited to walk along and support people that are in that same journey, that are just ready to move on to thrive.
Yeah, so. That's so wonderful, because really it's one of those things, right, where I think it would be very hard, maybe impossible, for someone who's not been through that to take someone's hand and bring them from survival mode into thriving. You know, I mean, I just don't know. It would take someone who really understands what it's like to be in those shoes and to heal and continue to recover, like in order to show that it's possible and remind people to move from the very, very deeply entrenched and conditioned beliefs that they may have been living under for so long, and into a new set of beliefs and way of seeing the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so wonderful. Yay. That's great. So now that we get to have a little snapshot of that, let's kind of go a little bit further back in time. And what I'd like to do is start at the very beginning, because I do think there are some important pieces of the story of just how did you and your former husband meet, and what was kind of the beginning of that relationship like?
Oh, thanks for asking. That's a great question. He was my high school sweetheart. So we met in high school. He was a year older than I was. So I was 16 and he was 17. And I came from, my parents were immigrants. So we moved to the United States when I was 10. And so I was kind of an angsty teenager. I was kind of, where do I fit in? We moved around a lot. My parents were wonderful, absolute, still are amazing people, and focused on caring for our family. So I think there was opportunity for a personality to come in and just shower me with love, shower me with praises, tell me I was wonderful, started to kind of tell me that maybe my parents could support me better. He had a job where he was able to treat me to things, and we used to go to dinners. And so really had that opportunity to really kind of show himself to be a person that I needed and someone that I was really craving. I really wanted to be seen and heard and understood. And at the time, he showed that to me and was able to provide that for me. And so I met him at 16 and we got married at 19. I was actually engaged my senior year of high school, which was not typical. And I knew that, but I do have a strong willedness about myself. So that's how we met.
Yeah. And just that feeling of being chosen, right? That can be such a powerful and intoxicating thing. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Where did you move? Where did your family move from?
My mom is English and my dad is Irish. So we actually moved from Ireland.
Oh, cool.
New York, and then moved to New Jersey. So that was in New Jersey.
Yeah. Had you ever had any relationships, like serious relationships before this? This was your very first one.
And which is first love, right? So that's the intoxication. I think that was a great word that you used. And to have a person enamored with you who doesn't want that. And then you put the financial component of, you know, you should buy yourself something nice. Here's some money to do that. Again, looking back on it, that's not very typical for a high school relationship. Well, not back when I was in high school anyway.
Right.
But again, just the draw and the attention and the, you know, setting that foundation really.
Yeah.
What was to come. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really drawing me in. Yeah.
Right.
Fascinating.
And that is part of what we're really hoping to do, you and I, today, is sort of breathe life into these patterns that we know exist when it comes to domestic violence. And in terms of terminology, like when I say domestic violence, or, you know, like, what would you describe? I don't want to limit what we're talking about by limiting my language, but when we're talking about these patterns, like, I guess I want to make sure, so check me if I'm using terminology that's not aligned with what we're speaking about.
Okay.
But, you know, when it comes to relationships like the one that you found yourself in, I do think that that seems to be a common thread where the beginning of the relationship is so, so good that you would be crazy not to like take someone up on this offer. Yes. Right. And so I think talking about that and how that is a common pattern, can we spend a moment on that? Because I think it is a really powerful piece.
Yeah. So the terminology is love bombing. So it is meeting every anticipated need that you would have. So we would, you know, he'd pick me up in my car, in his car. He's like, you don't need to drive anywhere. I'll pick you up. I will open the door for you. I will take you to what restaurant do you want to go eat at? Oh, let's spend the weekend together. Let's go to this festival. Let's do this. Let's do this. Oh, I heard you like this music. Let me buy you this CD. I'll call you tonight after I'm done work because I want you to know that I care for you and that you're important. All the things that you're kind of supposed to look for in a relationship, someone that whose actions and words align. So very much part of the cycle of drawing you in. And I do like, and again, Jamie and Gina would talk to more about this, but I do like the term of intimate partner violence, because yeah. I think sometimes with domestic violence, it's just that married relationship or very, you know, living together where these dynamics, obviously he lived a couple of towns over. So I didn't always see him during the week. It was on the weekend. So this
pattern
that was more part of an intimate partner relationship. So that caveat, I think that's important that these dynamics have to happen if you're not just living with a person or married to a person.
Yes. Thank you. That's what I was after.
Yeah.
So, and then that's another interesting component, right? Is if you don't live in the same town, then you're never there. There's always kind of something really exciting to look forward to with getting to spend time together. And then B, like, you're never actually quite yet living like everyday life together. Absolutely. It's always kind of a special occasion anytime you get to share time. And so I think that can be a really powerful thing too.
That's a good observation. Yeah. Absolutely a component.
Yeah. Okay. And so then just real quick before we move on, now I'm curious about, you are remarried, and the little bit that I know about your current husband, he sounds absolutely wonderful. And so I'm curious about, what was it like, you know, were there similar things that happened that we just consider to be chivalrous, or, you know, like you're saying, like a lot of the like love bombing that happened in that relationship, it looks like what we would expect on like an ideal dream, like rom-com scenario. Right. Yeah. Right. And so will you talk about like what that was like for you and how you could sort of differentiate those two, or how someone might differentiate those two things?
Such a good question. At 16, I didn't know who I was. I was looking for someone to take care of me, which can carry into adulthood. Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the biggest things that I needed to do, and I would recommend so highly as part of a healing journey, is you know who you are as a person. And I remember when I first left the relationship, someone's like, you get to live on your own for the first time. Like, that's amazing. And I remember, like, you can do all the things you like to do. And I remember saying to this person, I know that sounds good, but I don't know what I like. I've always been told. So the healing journey has been, what do I like? What kind of food do I like? And my kids were out of the house. So I actually got to figure, I wasn't making food for people. So when I entertained the thought of dating, it was like, no, I need to be on solid ground of who I am. What do I value? What are my triggers? How do I embrace this season and live it the best that I can? And then invite somebody in. And that person have to gain my trust.
Yeah.
And they're gonna need to prove to me who they are. So there was a lot of communication that happened when I first met my husband. And it was, thank you for holding the door. I appreciate it. And then I would go hold the door for him.
Yeah.
It was, oh, thank you so much for offering to pay. I'm going to go ahead and pay.
Yeah.
And then when I felt comfortable, obviously not on the first date, it was, so this is part of my past. And these are the things that are really important to me. And I see that you, this is part of your tradition and part of your identifying as a strong man. And I appreciate that. And I need to balance this out in my mind. And this has to be a process for me. So it started as friendship and it was having those conversations. I remember the first time he tried to hold my hand, he thought he was being so sweet and slick. And I was like, excuse me. Like, you don't just hold my hand. So it was teaching him, but it's a place of knowing what was important to me and how I needed to move forward to have a healthy relationship.
Oh, so good. That's super helpful. Yeah.
It's a lot of talking, a lot of communication, a lot of verbal processing, and inviting that person in to know the journey. And that was super helpful when I would get triggered and he was around, right? Those things that happened that reminded me, or he said
totally.
Something in our surroundings happened. And it was like, oh, I'm actually just, I'm having a little bit of anxiety. I'm actually having a panic attack right now. This is how you can help me. So and again, we were building trust with each other, right?
Yeah.
Like, he was showing that he was up for it. He was able to say, I don't know what I'm doing, but I want to know. Like, I want
to teach me.
And then when I said, I don't know, he's like, that's okay. I'll just sit with you. Let's just sit together.
So good.
And that is not a component of a narcissist or someone that is very focused on their needs being met. There would be no patience. Right. There'd be no tolerance.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I think that's really important to talk about, just that beginning piece. So then you got married super young.
Yeah.
And we'll just kind of walk through the next steps. And you and I talked about that, you know, a lot of our listeners are sort of in that area of life where they're either planning to have children, they're expecting children, or their children are still very young. So we are talking a little bit with that in mind. So just going into the part of the story, and you told me, you know, part of what was intriguing or attractive about being married young and getting into a relationship is like, you had always dreamed of being a mom, and that sounded really lovely to you. And you weren't really sure at a young age that you needed or wanted much more than that when it came to how you needed to spend your time. So maybe just we'll scooch into the next part of life and you can tell about that chapter.
Yeah. So we got married. I decided not to continue at college. I was like, I just want to be a mom. He wants a degree. I'll support him. So my education was put on the wayside, and that was great. And so I helped him. I worked full time, and he was getting multiple degrees. And we talked about having kids together. And one of the things, ironically, that attracted me to this person was I thought they would be a good dad. Mm-hmm. Really important to me. And I felt at 16 that I had that dialed in. I had seen him interact with children. That was a part that we had talked about together, that was very important to us both. So when we got pregnant, it was amazing and wonderful. And he was just finishing his degree. And so it was an okay time. It worked out where I could finish working full time and he was ending his degree. All happened within, you know, just a couple of months. So we had our daughter, and I can't recall anything standing out to me at that point that was a red flag. Part of the process of this interview is when you ask questions, in real time, I'm connecting dots, right? So one of the things that was consistent throughout our relationship was I would communicate to other people to cover him. I would say, he's really stressed. He's just under a lot of stress. And I would say that outwardly. I would say that to our children. I would say that like to myself. He's just really stressed. So what's interesting is I'm thinking about those first couple months when my daughter was born and him being very just like, she's your responsibility.
Mm.
Well, I'm actually not sure what to do. She's crying. I need help. And he's like, look, I was able to help you for a couple of weeks, but now it's on you. And like, I have to focus on schoolwork. He wasn't wrong. He was a student. That was his responsibility. And we had agreed upon that I was going to be the primary caregiver. But I remember now thinking in that moment, like, okay, that was harsh. Like,
yeah,
there's no compassion there. Like, I am a good mom, but I'm struggling. But in that interaction and that attitude moving forward, there was that beginning of, you're not a good mom.
Mm-hmm.
You should know what to do and you shouldn't need my help. It was that very subtle messaging.
Yeah.
Now, actually, as I'm talking, I'm realizing that was the root of, I've had to do a lot of healing around that. That was part of the narrative since the beginning.
Yeah.
So even though there was no hitting, that was where the emotional, psychological piece started to kind of just sit.
Yeah.
And so to the outside eye, he's just stressed. He's got paperwork he's got to do. He's a student. And now in being in a healthy relationship and a loving relationship, there is compassion, there is empathy, there is teamwork.
Yes.
Child together, not just one responsibility for the child, right? So.
Right.
Yeah.
And just because someone is stressed and busy doesn't mean that they have no access to compassion or empathy or, you know, I mean, those two things aren't mutually exclusive, right? And being a new mom is also very stressful. So it's not like you were absent of stress, you know? Yeah. Yeah. And so I wonder too, just as you're speaking about, you know, that at that time there weren't any, you weren't able to pick up on any like real overt red flags, as we say, which is often the case with red flags, right? Like it is common to look over them. That is why we have that language around what that means. But in your mind, I think there was this notion of one thing was like, he's going to be a really good dad. And you saw him interact with other children. And that was exciting to you and reassuring to you about, you know, having a family together. And then there start to be these reality checks where you're like, okay, but wait a minute, you know? And so I'm curious about Jamie and Gina. And I also talked a lot about this public persona versus this private reality that exists at home. And so maybe you can speak to how that began to develop as you had kids and it was kind of all on you and what that looked like. Were things different when other people were watching with him? Yeah. And so maybe just share about that.
So a part of my journey is that, and a part of our journey was we had a strong Christian faith. So my ex-husband wanted to be a professor. We went to Bible college. So it very much was a culture of submissive. Wife does stay at home. Because I was young, I did not have a circle of friends that were going through pregnancy or getting married. So it was very isolating to begin with. In that world, a male does have more, traditionally, should I say, a male is more forward thinking and is representative. So because he wanted to be a professor, it was very much being at church. It was being, you know, putting that face forward. And so that was a huge component of what was going on. Part of, how do I put it? It was part of the belief system and the values that helped sustain the cycle, helped me or kept me in it, but also very much a part of our world. So to that point, he would teach on Sundays at Sunday school, and it was up to me to take care of everything behind the scenes, whether it was one or we ended up having three kids together. We had three kids under the age of four. So it was, I was hurting my wonderful children. We were getting to church on time. Up until I left, the part of our history in Helena is that we were pastors at a larger church. And there are people to this day that do not know the story of what happened, because we were the idealistic couple. We were in ministry together. We had it all together, and we looked good. We were good. And we were giving leadership and guidance to others. So people had no idea. My family didn't know. Nobody knew what was going on, because that would have broken so many pieces. Our livelihoods, what people would say, our kids' lives, it would impact everything. So, yes, the public persona was you would have never guessed in a million years. And that's where I have really come to understand you just don't know what people are going through.
Yes.
You would have no idea.
Yes.
I was pulled together. I was looking good. I was successful at my job. And behind the scenes, that was not the case. And so that started when my kids were little, going to church, going on Sundays, going on Wednesdays, being part of that. So that really fueled his ego to be an inflated personality. He's very charismatic. People loved him. And I was his wife that supported him. So it was just this beautiful dream. Like, people just had no idea. And then behind the scenes, it was, you know, you spent too much time talking to so-and-so. I needed you to come and check on me. Why didn't you do XYZ? Why are you wearing that dress? You should have worn that dress. The kids were crying and they couldn't find you. Where were you? You know, we're going back on Wednesday. If that doesn't work for your schedule, that's too bad. That's what the expectation is, that we're there. So it just added a whole dynamic of expectation that, again, kept the system going.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think it's important to talk about the religious tradition piece, because I do think that it keeps a lot of people in these types of relationships.
Yes.
Because they ultimately feel, and not feel maybe, but they're involved in a belief system where this kind of fits, right? Like, you can apply the head of household thing, the submissive wife thing, even the like turn the other cheek thing.
Absolutely.
And I am like not anti-spirituality by any means. And you and I talked about that, but I do want to talk about how in Montana, there is still a lot of traditional practices going on like that and being reinforced. And, you know, I know people that you know and love still and care about still really believe that those things are the way to go. And so I would love to know, just as you've grown in your own faith journey and you look back, you know, what would you say to someone who is sort of like, yeah, but I'm supposed to respect him. Like, he's the head of the household. You know, when you look back at that piece, what's that like for your heart?
Such a big, important question. I 100% agree that I believed and I valued marriage. I got married to stay married, to have one partner. Divorce was not an option. I secretly judged people that were divorced, like, you guys can't hold it together. I come from a beautiful, big Irish family where no one has ever divorced.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody that was ever divorced.
Yeah.
It was not part of my language or my understanding. I made the commitment to marry a person. And if that person ended up being a jerk, well, that was just the cards I was dealt, and
it
would help me through.
Yeah.
Exactly. Love is patient. Love is kind. Turn the other cheek. Proverbs 31, woman, you do all the things. Your partner is out by the gates doing his business. And so part of my story is that part of the breaking point for me when I chose to leave was my partner was outwardly expressing, had been for a while, but I was able to finally hear it, was, you know, I don't like you. I don't care. You are just not meeting my needs. You are not doing this, this, and this. And so when I finally left, part of my coming to the divorce, because it was my choice to divorce, I came to the realization of, I'm helping him. This is a loving thing for me to do, because he really hates me and he doesn't want to be married to me. But because of his position, he's never going to choose divorce. I've reached the end of my rope. God will deal with me accordingly. But this is a way for me to love him, is to release him from this responsibility. And that's how I justified it.
Yeah.
And obviously you know, part of my story is that we were married for 23 years. So it took a long time to get to that point and other things involved. What I would say to myself is that if I was back there, I would say, like, God loves you as an individual, and God wants a relationship with you. And it is not about religion. It is not about man-made rules that say, that are based in patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And not seeing a woman for who she is, or seeing each individual for who they are. And that it is not the end of the world when you make that choice, that you being happy and loved and cared for and enjoyed and seen and heard and valued for who you are is far more important than a piece of paper. And that it is not the unforgivable sin that you will never recover from, that there is life on the other side, and your safety is so important, and you are enough, you are enough, you are enough, and you are loved, and you are cared for, and you are deserving of that love, care, and respect.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I wish I would have known that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the other thing is you get to love more, right?
Yes.
You get to love and care for the people in your life better and more fully, and offer grace and compassion, because you're not living in a state of constant terror.
Yes.
You know, and I think that that's the other thing that we don't really think about, is like when you're in that state and your nervous system is just turned up and ratcheted up as far as it possibly could be from morning till night, you know, you don't have access to your own capability to really love in the way that you are created to love. And I think that that's really important too. And I'm sure that having that ability again feels so good to you. You know, I mean, it feels good to be loved, but man, it feels good to love. And we can't if we're in unhealthy situations.
Well, part of the, I love how you just put that, part of the dance in a toxic relationship is that, or abusive relationship, is that you really want to love that person, and you want that person to love you, and you are willing to do whatever is required of you. And so the other person continues to move the target, and you're like, just tell me what to do. Like, you want me to do X, Y, Z? I've got it, because you don't want to live in the tension. So you have just as much desire to meet their needs as you want them to stop. And they're conveying that they want you to stop. So it's kind of this dance. So when you actually come out of it, it's like you're seeing, not only do you get to love, but you have someone that's looking at you saying, thank you for loving me this way.
Yes.
And you're doing it genuinely, authentically. And they're not saying, you know, and this really happened, was like, you made me peanut butter and jelly for lunch, but the peanut butter and the jelly were not perfectly in alignment. And so I took a bite of the sandwich, and the peanut butter did not match the jelly. And so, like, I need you to get that right next time. Like, you have one job. So Wow. Now I make my current husband lunch for work, and he's like, thank you so much for taking time. I know you work and you do this, and I feel so loved. And I'm like, it's just a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And
he's like,
I feel seen, and you know that. So it's so radically different,
yeah.
So radically different. And then that fills your cup of like, oh, yes. You see my heart. Like, that is when I knew my Dean was the man for me, was when he saw me loving him authentically, and yeah. He loved me for who I was. I was being yeah. seen and heard, all of it involved. And
he's so good. Oh, I love that example. Yeah. And so I do want to, now that we're kind of into it further, one thing that was most instructive for me when you and I spoke before, and I got to know more about your story and your family's story, is like, kind of like we did when we started the episode, like a day in the life of Lisa. Oh, yeah. But at that time, because I think that it was hard for me to fathom how constant this was for you, like the feeling of being afraid and guessing and the moving target and managing everyone else's states of being, not just your children, which we all know is hard enough, but then another layer. So let's like really, unless you were, I want you to tell the story, but I was going to say really, unless you were unconscious, like you had no relief, but then you also shared with me that like actually sleeping was scary too for different reasons.
Right.
So there really wasn't any time where you could let your guard down at all. But tell me, like, from, you know, your kids are little, they're cute and scrumptious, like all little loves are. And you wake up in the morning, your eyes open, and then bam, it's like go time for you. So will you walk us through a typical day?
Yeah. So I have a little one in the bassinet in our master bedroom. And then I have two little ones. So they're both under the age of four in another bedroom. And I've hoped that they haven't woken up down the door. But I kind of, my eyes pop open and I'm like, okay, what do I need to be prepared for? So I'm actually feeling this in my body now.
Yeah, I can see
eyes
that.
Open. Okay, baby's still sleeping, can't hear the other two kids. What's going on with my partner next to me? Okay, if I indicate in any way that I'm awake, then it's going to begin. However, if I'm not prepared for when I have to have, you know, the kids' breakfast figured out, I have to be prepared for what my partner is going to anticipate when he wakes up. I'm kind of almost, I wake up frozen. Like,
yeah.
What is the least risky thing for me to do? Is it to get up, wake my partner up, and have the yelling or the expectation begin? Or do I lay here, wait for him to wake up, maybe just not care that I'm in the bed, roll out and go about his business and get started? So it really was like having a fourth child.
Yeah.
It really was. And you and I talked about having like always being like five steps ahead, right? Like, yeah. Hey, we just had breakfast. We have to leave the house in 30 minutes. These are all the things that need to be done before we get out of the door. And I've got three and I've got a dog, like what, all the things, right? So then you have this extra layer of this partner that in no way is interacting with your day. So it's not like I'll feed child one, I'll take care of the dog. Like it's none of that. It's like solely focused on themselves. So it's almost like having a teenager, not a child. Like they're just self-absorbed. So this component of taking care and being five steps ahead, but then also, okay, this person's tense. I understand my partner has XYZ on their plate. So they are going to need these things from me. How can I help them? And again, that loving component, like you want to love them well. So you're like, hey, how do I show up and be loving? Because at that point, very much a part of the dialogue was, you care more about the kids than me. You're not taking care of my needs. Why, you know, we don't spend enough time together. Why don't you have the kids taken care of so that I have more one-on-one time with you? Clearly, we all know, especially in the audience, that's not feasible. Like the kids are the focus, but that was not, the expectation was very different.
Yeah.
And so that was, I like to say, you know, the cartoon characters, the old cartoons where you would have a devil and an angel. It's like, I didn't do that. I literally had a person in my life telling me all the things that I was doing wrong, all the things like, why is so-and-so wearing that? Did you know that so-and-so is playing with that? I thought we agreed that that wasn't going to be a thing anymore. Did you take care of this bill? Did you, like, it was kind of like I was the house manager and they were doing their own thing and was very narrowly focused on their responsibilities. And then everything else was my responsibility. And if it was not done to their satisfaction, there was no room to be authentic. There was no room to be myself. It was in compliance with what the expectations were, doing the checklist and taking care of that. And so when he would be out of the house, that is when I would kind of release. So if we woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning and he didn't leave till 9, it was that tension for those 2 hours of how do I care for everybody by myself. It was very common for me to go to lunchtime and go, oh, I didn't eat. And it's not because I was hungry. It's not because it did not dawn on me because I was 100% caregiver.
Totally.
And then I would, you and I talked about kind of creating quiet time, like what I do to relax. I would escape in books. So I would read books, but it was like, I would just create a safe zone where my kids were like, okay, this is what we're all doing. Mommy wants to read. We're all having quiet time, or we're having time in this room. I'd have the baby gates up. It's like, okay, everyone's cool. Just fed the baby. We're good. We didn't do electronics, so I did not have that. I did not have that component. So it was like puzzles or books. And then I would read. And then it was like, okay, dad's going to be home in an hour. This is what needs to be done. And there was very like clearing up. Things had to be tidy. Think dinner had to be a certain way on the table at a certain time. And then thankfully he was a perpetual student. My hope was after dinner that he would go and study, because that would leave me some time to actually get set, reset for the night, and then be able to plan for the next day. However, if there were other expectations, I was at his disposal and I still needed to get everything taken care of. But there was that added component and pressure of being available for what he expected or wanted the evening to look like. So,
yeah, my God.
It was a lot, but it was normal. Like, that's my normal. And I didn't have a comparison. I was young. At this point, we had moved across the country. So our family was on the East Coast and we moved to Portland, Oregon. So even the 3-hour time difference, my wonderful family were not his biggest fans. So they did not engage a lot. And I liked it that way because he was telling me things about how my family was feeling about me, right? Like, you're the black sheep. They don't love you like they love your brothers. Like, you know, I told you you're weird. Of course you're weird. They don't talk to you. So it was a very isolating life. And I wanted to keep that facade going. Like, it was, what was I going to tell people at church, Bible study? I just knew. And then there was the component, my husband was in ministry. He was a pastor. So I was a pastor's wife. So I wore that title. And that very much was, we protect, we have boundaries. It was all cloaked under boundaries, but like, we lived in a fishbowl. So we had a lot of eyeballs on us and we kept that narrative going because it was our livelihood.
Yeah, totally.
Our livelihood. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's so much there. I just like wish I could reach through the screen and hug you because that's so intense. And I know you know that, but one thing that I feel like this made me think of when Jamie and Gina and I were talking in the episode before this, just about different types of abuse and the evolution of these patterns and gradual subtle like escalation of things, is we talked about gaslighting and we talked about how verbal and emotional abuse sort of are like the beginning or like the seeds that can really start to like, things start to deteriorate, but you don't know that they are because you're under the impression that if I get some of this right, or maybe just anything right, things will get better or things will go back to how they were in the beginning when he cared for me and he was kind and, you know, all of these things that like, who did I marry? You know, like it, and you start to believe that it is all on you, and as like messed up and totally imbalanced and unfair that is, there's also like this prolonged sense of hope that if I just get it right, then things will get better. And I can do that. Like, I'll keep trying to do that. And eventually I'll become the wife that he wants me to be, or I'll become the mom that he wants me to be. And Jamie said, you know, a lot of people don't want to leave their relationship. They don't want to end things. They want this awful behavior to go away, and they want the person they fell in love with to come back. Yeah. And that is what keeps people like a lot of times really in this cycle of like, I can do that. I got this, right? Like, I got this, even though it's the most, that is like the most unmanageable day I've ever heard of. But like, you know, you learned to manage it and you just thought no matter how much more got added to your list of things you needed to be on top of, like there was a part of you that had come to believe that you could master it. Yeah. And in doing so, everything would be solved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If he needed his peanut butter and jelly sandwich to be a certain way, you just told me the solution. I'm going to do it that way from here on out. You don't want the dress I'm wearing? Gone. I'll just wear another dress. What dress do you want me to wear? And it's happening, you have that hope, and you're also kind of believing that you're crafting yourself into a perfect person.
Yes.
But what we don't realize is that little bits and pieces are being lost. So it's like, oh, you don't like that dress? I really like that dress. Like, I
think
that dress makes me look fabulous. But what I'm hearing you say is that you think I look inappropriate in that dress. Well, that dress is gone. Like, easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's no way after the, something like that has been expressed that you're ever going to be able to wear that again.
Absolutely. Case in point, he hated color. So by the time I left, I had all black. I hate black. So part of my revolution has been, or my reformation has just been like, oh, that's colorful. I like that. I wear a lot of blue.
Right.
I wear a lot of pink. I wear like the better, you know, I use color markers. Like, I'm like color.
Yeah.
It's like, he doesn't even know, but it's like, hey, I'm like breaking this narrative that you have. So you lose yourself in that hope, but you're so unaware because you're focused.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the Christian piece of, well, a wife takes care of the home. So I don't know what goes in other people's homes, but this is what I chose. I choose to marry. I chose to have these children. I'm choosing to believe in the institution of marriage. So I am going to do whatever I can to be a good wife, because that's what's being asked of me. And that's what I want to please God do. So, and I want to see a good, healthy marriage.
Totally. Yes.
Yeah. So it feeds into each other. It's all like a web.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just not being able to like ask yourself anymore, like, oh, do I like that? Why? Wait, what? Who cares what I like? You know, it's like you just sort of give up on that. Because I think another thing that happens is like, well, I'm only supposed to be dressing for my husband to please him. Right? It's like not only are these sometimes held like within the church community, but it's also this thing of like if you're in a committed relationship, then you shouldn't be trying to like call attention to yourself.
Exactly.
You know, I think of the color thing, and it's like that, even that could be like, oh, you just love people for people to like, you want to catch someone's eye, and like that becomes the accusation. Yeah.
Absolutely. You get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And then, I mean, I think that illustrates just sort of the intensity of the walking on eggshells that you talked about, along with the kind of like moving target piece. But I also want to make sure that we touch on how much more complicated things can get for people who are in interpersonal, you know, violent situations or abusive relationships when they do have children, because then it becomes, like you said, like not only are you trying to model like what the longevity of marriage and like what marriage is and how like even if things get hard, like for better or worse, I'm sticking around, you know, like there's that element, but there's also just this thing of like, well, if I go, that means that I'm no longer taking the brunt of this, and my kids might then become targets of verbal and emotional abuse. That can be the case for some people. So then it's like, it's hard to think of leaving your partner and trying to like make it on your own, you know, not even mentioning the financial challenges there, but also just having, then you're not there to be the in-between between your kids. And I don't think, from what you've told me, like that wasn't a huge, there wasn't a lot that was directed toward them. It was all directed toward you, in terms of the constant berating and demeaning. But I just wonder, you know, if you could speak to a little bit about that, of like, let's touch on different barriers of why people don't leave.
Okay. So, part of my story was that I didn't finish college. So if I had left, I didn't even have a college education. So I wasn't even going to make minimum wage. There was no way for me to, and which is very common in the financial abuse, is like, I did not have my own credit card. I didn't have my own, say everything was joint. And so all the transactions had, like, if I did try and do something, or if I tried to open a credit, our credits were attached, right? So anything and everything that I did, and this was well before social media is the way that it is. Like, there's technological abuse where they'll stalk you and look through your stuff. So financially, I had no move to make. I had been told from the very beginning that that seed had been planted that I was not a good mom, right? So it's like I was holding on to every hope of redeeming that, of being a good mom. Well, I know a mom doesn't, in my eyes, a bad mom would divorce their partner because they wouldn't see the value, right? So I equated that to that I was isolated. If I walked out my front door, I did not have a credit card. I did not have someone that knew anything that was going on, let alone a support system.
Yeah.
Where was I even going to go? We had one car, right? Like, so, and my family didn't know. So it's not like I could call my family and be like, oh, by the way, this has been happening for years. I'm in crisis. So you have that lack of support and that lack of, and I wasn't going to leave. Yeah. Without my kids, because I knew that they would be exposed. Yeah. And they would get the brunt of it. And when it became evident, it took a turn when it's almost like he could see the wheels turning. And I was like, okay, what does this look like? How, like, I think we would have conversations of like, okay, if you hate me so much, like, mm-hmm. how do we make this work? Right? Like, if I'm such an awful person, you're telling me I'm a bad mom, like, you know, you're telling me that, you know, like all these things, then why don't we just separate? Why don't we just leave? And it would be the, if you tried to leave with my kids, I would kill you. And you would never see your children again. And nobody in their right mind, because you're such a shady mom, no one in their right mind would give you custody of these kids. So you make the choice. You can walk out the door. I don't know personally how you're going to do it because you have no money. You know, the church knows that I'm awesome. Your family doesn't like you. You don't have an education. Mm. So, like, what are you going to do? It was this, oh, my God, like, yeah. I am trapped. I have no way out. But you never, you're not going to leave without your children. Like, you protect your kids. So it's not an option. It's just not an option. It's not an option.
Yeah.
And then you're like, how do I even buy diapers? How do I buy formula? We were on, you know, social services. We had WIC. So it was like, okay, our taxes are joined. Our finances are joined. Yeah. It's not like I can, you know, so there was the, well, he could call social services. And if I'm as awful as I'm starting to believe that I am, and he picture, he is charismatic. He is believable. Nobody knows what's going on. He thinks I'm crazy. He's telling me I'm crazy. So like, am I going to actually go accuse him of something when this is clearly, he's very eloquent. And I don't have a college education. So it's so complicated. And then you have beliefs and you have societal restraints.
Yeah.
I mean, I did end up getting a college education, and that was huge. He agreed that it would be good for me to get a college education and then hated it. So I fought my way through that. And that was an awful few years. But there was and there is a spunk within us as survivors that are just like, we will make this work and we are going to get through this.
Yeah.
We don't know how. But there is a piece of us that is so determined. And somebody asked me once, like, what made you at times poke the bear? Like, if you didn't, like, you knew if you poked the bear, the cycle would just continue. Like, what is it? And I was like, I don't know. I think there would just be times where I would just be so frustrated that it would just be like, nope, I'm dying on this hill. I cannot take it anymore. I know exactly what's going to happen, but I am going to college. This is what's going to happen. And I see I don't know if there's a way out of this, but if nothing else, for my kids to see that a college education is valuable, and a woman's worth is valuable, I do this. And that's where the beautiful reframing can happen from moving to thriving to thriving is like you're repeating back that that's an awful day and you don't think about it in the moment because you're just getting it done. Of course I could get a college education. I was dealing with that stuff. I was managing an outward persona as well as raising healthy children and supporting a man as he was doing his career that grew and grew, right? Support he was receiving. So it's like, if we no longer, and you alluded to it earlier, like if you no longer have that weight and that responsibility and that burden, we have so much energy. We have so much capacity to do so much good because we get shit done. Our superpower. We are superpower.
Yeah. And that's one thing that Jamie and Gina really focus on that I really love when in our episode that we recorded is like they talk about, you know, we would never ever tell someone what they need to do. Like they are the experts, and being the experts in the way that survivors are means that they have survival strategies that make no sense to anyone else on the outside and are crucial to keeping things the safest they possibly can be on the inside. Right. And that's what I hear you saying is like, when we ask, like, and I think people just that are completely unaware and ignorant about what this kind of a situation is like, they will say like, why didn't you just leave? Right. Like they have no clue how complicated that is. And it places blame also on the victim, but it's also just like, when you think about the constant strategizing that you had to do from the moment you opened your eyes till the moment you shut them again, and even in between, like that's what I hear you saying, and I hear Jamie and Gina saying this, like when you have that much of a strategist, like, and you put them on a good project, like watch out, you know, because those skills are so sharp and what it takes to even consider taking on, like you shared, that long list of scary barriers and challenges to overcome. Like even that's why there's so much respect in even taking that very first step of like contacting the Friendship Center, because all the things that you know you might have to do after that first step, that's like such a daunting thing to take on that it is just so commendable when people are even willing to like call the crisis line, you know, and
you have to be at a really desperate place to be willing to take that risk. Because sometimes you don't know, you really have no idea.
Yeah.
What the next step is, or sometimes people, and this happened when I called the Friendship Center, was like, is this what I'm feeling? Is this what I think it is? Or I did not know until a counselor, I was in counseling and the counseling's like, have you ever considered that maybe this is an abusive relationship? Yeah. And I was like, what? Like my husband's just a jerk. Right. Like, what are you talking about? So then it's like, oh, well you could call the Friendship Center. They might be able to give you some resources or some material that you could read. And so part of being in part of this relationship is, I didn't take books out of the library, right? I didn't look online. You know, again, the culture looks very different online now, but it's like, he could search my history. Nobody knew, so they didn't have podcasts. So it was like actually talking to someone. I wasn't going to write any information down. I could gain information. I could hang up the phone. I could make up a story about why I called the number accidentally. Like, and I would do it outside of the house so he wouldn't be in hearing distance. So strategizing even that was like, okay, but I have to have a plan, because if he looks that number up and sees that it's part of the Friendship Center, what am I going
to
do?
Yeah. Like you said, you always had to be like 25 steps ahead of everything and think of every possible scenario and what could result from that. Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is kind of a natural segue into, you know, just talking a little bit more about your specific experience with the Friendship Center. And I know they were really instrumental in your story and just helping you take those first scary initial steps. And So let's do that. You know, let's talk about what that was like for you to make that decision and what it looked like for you to have to figure out how to make that first call.
Yeah. So I don't believe I would be alive if it wasn't for the Friendship Center. Their work is so important. And anything I could do to support them and just to meet other survivors where they're at is so, so, so important. Part of the complexity for me was when I reached out to the Friendship, before I reached out to the Friendship Center, was at the time I had myself become a pastor. And so a lot of church folks volunteer at crisis centers, do nonprofit work. And so I was so afraid of calling and somebody recognizing who I was. And so somehow, I think it was my daughter who was at college at the time. She's like, when you call, you don't have to give any identifying information. And I was like, oh, okay. And they're like, it's 100% confidential. So they are not allowed to say or tell. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. So that took a little bit to even trust, but I was like, oh, I can't call. Okay. Okay. And I remember calling at the encouragement of my counselor to ask about a restraining order. And it was just wanting information. And they walked me through the process. Yeah. And I was like, I can't do that. Nope. I had no idea what that actually involves. I can't do it. Thank you so much. They were respectful. They were professional. They saw me as a human. Yep. They didn't dummy things down. They were not like, who are you walking in here or thinking less of me or looking at me in judgment? It was, here's the information you're requesting. How can we help? You need to leave. This isn't helpful. Absolutely no problem. Here's how you contact us again. When you're ready, we're here. And if we don't talk to you again, yes, you know, it's been a pleasure meeting you. Like, utmost respect. Mm-hmm. It was 2 years later that I contacted them. And the other thing that I did not know was my counselor was like, if you contact the Friendship Center, they can help you find a divorce attorney because this personality is going to be very hard to divorce and they will know the right people in town to know. So again, I did not come from a family of divorce, so I didn't know how to get a divorce attorney. I wasn't, again, because of the church piece, I didn't even know how to go about that. I had no friends that had gone through it. So it really was, how does someone get divorced? How much does it cost? What does it even look like? Like very basic information. And what's interesting in my story was they recommended two amazing lawyers. And the person on the other line said, given the things that you've told me, it is very common for an abuser to hire the best attorney that takes on abused women as clients so they can have that forward facing persona and they kind of take that option off the table for you. And that's exactly what happened. He hired the person that they recommended, but I called back, they recommended somebody else. And so even that was educational and like opening. Third time I contacted them was, and I believe I talked to Jamie from the very beginning when I talked to a restraining order. And then like 3 years later, I talked about the restraining order again. And I said, I'd like to come in and I really need to talk about this. I don't want to do this because I had been divorced for a year at that point, but stalking became a very, very real threat in my life. And so over the course of, because I had had that initial conversation, because I had known that information, we have great memories. Right. So we like that. I was able to say, okay, part of me not doing it the first time was, okay, I'm not in a position when this all blows up, this is going to be bad. I need be in a better position to be able to manage this and be able to prepare. So when I came back the second time, it wasn't, or about the restraining order, it wasn't a long drawn out conversation. It was, can you please walk me through this again? here's what's happening. Can you tell me if I need to do this? Because it feels really scary, but I've only been removed from the situation a year. These are the steps that I'm taking. And it was that confirmation of, yeah, this is bad. And yes, this is what we would recommend that you do. And this is the process. And we're going to walk with you every step of the way. So from there, what happened was a officer came to take a statement. They stayed with me there in the office. They photocopied things for me. When you get a restraining order, you have to have proof. And I had a lot of text messages and screenshots and emails. And I was able to, they photocopied all that for me. And then two of their representatives went to court with me when I was there and actually sat with me and helped offer support when I was going through that process. And so every step of the way, they were there. Just so much respect, treated me with, I want to say tenderness, but it wasn't tenderness. It was just this, we see you, we hear you, we're with you. And we're trusting you to tell us what to do. How do we support you? Instead of, okay, we've done A, now it's time to do B, C, D, and this is the path. There was none of that. And to have someone actually recognize that I had agency and that I knew what was best for me after being married to someone that told me I was wrong from day one was so immensely comforting and empowering. And like, oh, they see, I'm actually a human in this person's eyes. I'm not a human in this person's eyes that's supposed to treat me otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And they trust you to trust yourself in knowing that you know what needs to happen next. Now I have to take that and apply it to my situation in my own life because every single one is so unique and the risks and the stakes are different in every single situation, right? So no one's going to know what to do that is best except for you. Yeah. And I think that they're very, very adamant about that. Like, we're not here to save people. We're not here to rescue people. We're not here to boss people around. We are here to give people the tools and the information that they need in order to make the moves they need to be safe.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was, they offered validation. What you're experiencing is what would be considered an abusive relationship. Yes. This is common in an abusive relationship. What you are experiencing is you are not crazy. This is intentional. Yeah. This is manipulative. Right. I'm speaking facts and speaking validation, which outside of my counselor was the first person, you know, that's safe to.
Yeah. And I do want to have you speak a little bit more to the reality of the stalking piece, because we talked about that a lot in our interview, Jamie and Gina and I, because it's just so important. And because of the nature of technology and everything and that exists these days, like it's easier than ever for stalking to happen, because there's location devices and there's all kinds of things where you're like under surveillance all the time. And so I do want to talk about like what that was like for you. And I'm curious too, like, did it take some time after the restraining order was put in place? Were you like pretty immediately relieved, or did it take you time to like be like, oh, I wonder if he'll even care about this or not?
I have real fear that he will hear this. There could be questions from this interview. So that is real. Mm-hmm. That's a real thing. That's what I live with on a regular basis. And he has moved out east, so he is within driving distance of where I am currently. So I have come to terms with the fact that he's probably always aware of what I'm doing, where I live. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's ever going to go away. Mm-hmm. Just to speak to that piece first. So with the stalking piece, I left. There was a crisis situation. Safety was, I was in immediate danger and I left the situation and I went and stayed at an Airbnb again, because of the circles that I was in, I couldn't ask someone to stay on their couch. I couldn't use a credit card to get at a, I had my own Airbnb account. So I figured they don't give you the address until you pay. And if it comes up, there's no way he'll contact me. It was a tiny little place attached to someone's house, like part of town. And I was there for 24 hours and I was leaving and I noticed his truck was across the street. And I was like, oh my God, like I haven't even been gone 24 hours. Like I haven't even been gone 48 hours. Like how, and I just remember like even now just feeling that fear of like, I just need a minute. Just that, oh, he's going to kill me. I'm not coming out of this alive. Like I can't even leave. And I remember, I don't even know if I left. I think I needed to leave. So I drove where I needed to go. He didn't follow, but I remember the next night I had an event that I needed to go to. And I remember checking out the window and I could see that again, he was across the street. And I remember turning off all the lights, getting into the center of this room and just bawling my eyes out and going, what am I supposed to do now? It was dark. It was right after Christmas. So there was lots of snow on the ground. I was just like, it's his move. Like he still has control. He still has control. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what's going on. And so I had to leave that location. That person had booked. The legislation was in session. So all the Airbnbs became booked. And this sweet woman knew something was going on. And I had contacted her and said, is there any way that you have that I can extend this visit? Do you know anybody else that has a place? And for whatever reason, she innately knew that something was going on. And she goes, I have a property. It's not ready for Airbnb status, but you can stay there. And this is the rate. And I said, okay, I'll do it. It was on the top of a hill. There was one other house. It was under construction. And he wrote me an email and said, you don't think I know where you are, but I see your car parked at the top of the hill. And I know that you're in that house. How he knew, to this day, I don't know.
Yikes.
Did he approach me? Could I have... like it doesn't matter. It's the terror that the person puts inside you.
Yes.
Watching you just going about your business. So it escalated to the point that led to me getting the divorce. And then I thought, okay, now legally we're divorced. Like now he's going to understand that the boundaries have been a part because of his behavior leading up to getting divorced. We had an intermediary. We had to hire someone. I was in one room and he was in the other room and the mediator.
Yeah. A mediator
went
yeah.
back and forth. Again, lawyers told me this was not normal, but like our mediation went on for like 10 hours. And he was waiting. He would wait for me to go to the bathroom. And so they had me go to the bathroom with someone because they knew that he was trying to watch to threaten me. We finished mediation and they let him leave first on purpose. And his lawyer contacted my lawyer and said, please wait for him to leave. I will let you know when he's gone, but it's not good for your client to leave the building.
Wow.
We're getting ready to leave. And she called back in a panic and she said, he's not gone. He's waiting. Be very, very safe. Be careful. So there was that ever present threat. So it wasn't just now about me. He was showing others that he wanted to dominate and control. And that heightens your like, oh, if he's willing to do that after 25 years of not showing that card, then he's agitated and he's going to do anything. He's out of his mind.
Yep.
And I understood enough to know that his life is unraveling right before him. So he's trying to control it.
Yes.
So the divorce happened. It seemed to kind of calm down. I didn't work at the church anymore. He didn't work at the church anymore. I found a job. And then what happened was in the divorce, I had a P.O. box. So I never listed my address on anything. I had found a new place to live at that point, and I didn't give out my phone number. So I had an email address. So part of the agreement was if you need to contact Lisa in regards to childcare or anything to do with kids, it has to go through this email. And I created a different email. It was not attached to other ones. And I had a friend who would monitor it for me because he would write me pages of emails. Why did you do this? You are such a blah, 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 blah. I see you doing this. Yeah. You're trying to get on with your life. Yeah. I didn't read majority of those, but actually took that and photocopied that and read some of those for evidence for this stuff, for the thing. What were some of the other things? He would send me text messages when he knew I wasn't supposed to take text messages. I took screenshots of that. He would show up at locations that I was at. I saw him driving around. I was in an apartment complex, third floor. I could see out the window. And he would drive around the parking lot. Like he didn't know, I don't know if he knew which apartment was mine, but like I had safety devices in the apartment so that if he were to come, I carried a baseball bat in my car. I did not want to carry a gun. I would call somebody when I left my apartment and say, I need to be at work and I'm driving straight to work and I should be there in 10 minutes. I would then text that person and say, I arrived at work. I would then text someone and say, I'm going to the corner to get coffee. I'm just going to get coffee. I'm going to have my phone on me at all times. And instead of, you know, you have your keys, like as a woman, you're just like ready to kind of stab someone. I just had my phone at the ready at all times. I never wore my headphones because I didn't want someone to sneak up on me. And so it got to a point where it was almost a full year since our divorce. And he contacted me and wanted to take me on a date and said, it's our anniversary. I would like to take you on a date. And I thought, oh, this is a new level of crazy. This is a new level of not understanding the full picture here, and listed out reasons why, you know, you shouldn't be in another relationship. 50% of second marriages fail. So you should just make a go at the first one. Like just not clear thinking at all.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I was like, I am not going to be free of this person. Our son graduated early and went to college in the summer, a year after we divorced. And so part of his persuasion with the emails was, you know, we have an empty nest now, so we can fully focus on restoring our relationship. I saw you were on a dating app, so I would like to, you know, we'd be a perfect match and just all this stuff. And so it got to a point where I was just like, I'm never going to become free. Like if a divorce isn't going to work to allow this person to understand that this is over, it's been a year. I'm never going to be free of this. I need help. I need somebody else intervening. And so I left the courtroom, got the restraining order. I got in my car. I had packed up all my stuff in my car. My mom was with me and we drove to the East Coast and I did not look back. And to your question of, did I feel safe or relieved? It's just shock. The adrenaline's running. I don't believe I would have been safe even with that piece of paper after I was in the court. Like I understood. And once I got to where I am now, I still would notice a truck and I'd be like, oh my God, he's here. Or someone that looked like him. And I'm 3,000 miles away at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think because I'm choosing to embrace my voice and become to let my desires for others to know that they can survive this too, that fear of being exposed is definitely full front again. But again, I've never lost sight of the fact that he, in his rage, he could easily end my life and that would be it for me. So I understand that. And there's freedom and power that comes with that because it's like, okay, I've accepted that. That's part. And I'm still going to do this anyway.
Yeah.
That comes with that is reclaiming it and recognizing you can continue to do whatever you want, but I'm going on my terms. And if that happens, I'm going to tell as many people as possible to give them hope and to give them a different way of living, if possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize before speaking with Jamie and Gina that the level of like the increased risk of lethality once stalking becomes a part of the equation. Once someone starts stalking, like it's much more likely that they are willing to kill their partner. Like that is, yeah, because they talk about what you're talking about, that the loss of control is an intolerable sensation for them. Mm. And so the break with reality that you're describing is like, you know, due to the fact that their control is the only way that they feel okay. And so if that is taken away from someone who that is a part of their makeup, they will do anything to get it back, to the point where things go to a break in sanity, right? And so I think that was something that was really illuminating to me. And as you describe your situation, I'm like, oh yes, okay, I see what that looks like now. And yeah, and I just the amount of ongoing terror that places on victims is hard for me to think about. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing all of that. I don't even know what to say. It's just so frightening. I think one other piece before we wrap up that I wanted to talk about is that I think is really admirable and commendable about your story is you talk about, you know, your kids are older now and they have grown now and you are able to have conversations with them that are honest about what happened and some of the repair that you've done in your own relationships with them, but also just teaching them like, okay guys, so now that you're going to be forming relationships, you know, what you saw was not what I want for you. And so maybe you can talk about that because I think that is probably one of the toughest pieces is like having to have those conversations with your kids and just talk about what happened.
Yeah, I have always been open about therapy and see the importance of it. So that was part of our language when the kids were growing up. And so this really, with this, when this situation, like when the divorce happened, it was, okay, this is really important of my healing journey and it needs to be an important part of your healing journey. Because they were older teenagers, older young adults, you can't tell them what to do easily mm-hmm. as when they're two or three or cute and little. And so that wasn't something that they were open to. And so I worked with my therapist and the way that I revisited the conversation with them at the time was, I understand. And it would be counterintuitive for you to go to therapy, for me to tell you had to go to therapy. Let's be clear what happens in therapy. That person is your advocate. You get to share whatever you want to behind closed doors. That is between you. It is a safe person that is confidential. Like, let's make sure we're understanding. And this isn't for you right now. And I'm just going to encourage you that when you are ready to have a healthy and intimate relationship, that you please consider going to counseling at that point, because what's been patterned for you, what the relationship that was modeled for you was not healthy. And I do not want that for you or your partner. Not that I'm accusing you of being that person, you're not, but there are dynamics that you are exposed to that are not healthy. And so, all three of my kids have chosen to do that. I do still have no contact with their dad. And so that has been an also very important part of the conversation is I don't need to know about what's going on with him. And I'm just going to ask that you don't share information about me. So when I moved, it was like, I'm not going to be out of state. And actually he found out that I was moving out of state, but it was, you know, you don't need to share where I live. You don't need to share the ins and outs. And I'm going to respect you having a relationship with both parents. I'm going to respect that you are, I'm not going to ask you questions and put you in the middle. More recently, so it's been 6 years now, more recently, we've been able to have those conversations of, I understand who your dad is. I'm not going to interfere with that relationship. I'm not going to badmouth him, which obviously has been, that didn't just happen in the last 6 years, but it has been from the beginning. I'm not going to badmouth. I'm not going to slander. I'm not going to interfere with the relationship that you have with him because he is your dad. However, if you ever want to talk about dynamics that you're observing, if you ever want to talk about certain things or have questions, I am able to answer. And then again, in conjunction with working with my therapist, there was some information that I felt like it was important for my kids to know. And so the way that she guided the conversation was just saying, you know, you give your kids the info. If your kid asks a question, you answer the question and don't give any more information than what they're asking for, because they're ready to handle that piece of information. And you just let them know the conversation is open. And so I have had to share some information and said, I'm sharing this with you because I think it's important. We never have to speak of it again, but it is an important piece of the dynamic. If you have questions, I will do my best to answer them. If I have a hard time answering your question, I will take the time to process and will come back to you with an answer. And if it is a question that I don't feel comfortable answering, I'm just going to let you know that that's not something that I want to discuss. But I respect the journey that you're on and you respect my journey as well. And so I just try and model that for them, is that that give and take and that understanding of, you're asking me a question, but you may not want to know all the answers, like the whole picture, right? And I told them that I'm going to answer the question you ask. And then if you want to come back later and have another question, that's great. So we've had some good conversations that way. And we continue to navigate that space because there are details that I don't feel I'm ready to talk about publicly and don't need them to know about. And that may change in the future, but that's my story to tell. And we are muddling through because they're as much victims as I was, and they are survivors and they are thriving, and their dad is still very much a part of their life. And I honor that and I respect that that's their choice to make.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's some good parenting right there. I feel like that is such a healthy example of boundaries and respect and reciprocation. Thanks for sharing that. Because I'm sure that's not easy. And I feel like that's the best possible thing you could possibly have in terms of communication around all of this. You know, it just seems like such a loving approach to me.
Thanks. As your kids get older, you're not parenting them anymore. You're coaching them. And so that's what it is. Yeah. It's modeling, and it's very much modeling that communication, because the communication wasn't modeled healthily for them.
Right.
Hey, just because I want to talk about something doesn't mean you want to. You don't want to go to counseling. Yeah. You actually have a choice in that, because what was modeled for you was I complied and I did everything I was told to, and you knew the consequences if I didn't. And so you need to know that you have agency, that I trust you to know what's best for you. And that is more important to me. And if we don't talk for long periods of time, I would rather that and have a healthy relationship than you feel like you have to talk to me about stuff that's uncomfortable. Like I feel like I am teaching them through not only relationship dynamics intimately, but also communication style and values and seeing another person and trusting that person to know their own worth and the respect. It just, none of that was there.
Yeah. That's the perfect example of like how these struggles become superpowers, right? Now you're able to learn everything that you fought so hard to be able to learn and use this wisdom to teach your children in a way that's like pretty unique. And if I may, very badass when it comes to parenting, like, and I'm thinking of my own mom who has some of these skills you're sharing. And I'm so grateful that she does, because it's really, I do feel like it's really benefited our relationship, and it makes me a better mom, you know, to be able to be humble and be willing to, you know, acknowledge when I mess up and all of these things. And so
that's our promise, yeah. Right? Is that our kids will learn from our mistakes, and that we can empower them to step into their strength and to be the best that they can be. And that is, there is no higher compliment as a mom, is that your child can turn around and learn from you and be even a better parent.
Yep. And when you, yeah. And when you think back to, you know, that very, those very first weeks of your very first baby and that seed that was planted, and then the way that that sprouted and grew into you believing that you were a terrible mother.
Yeah.
Like when we go back to that time and then now here you are, like with this completely different crop and harvest, it's just such a beautiful thing, Lisa. It is. It's like the reclamation and redemption of so much. And so I think that that's probably a good place to wrap things up. And, you know, I just would ask that if there's anyone listening and you could speak directly to them, knowing that they're living under like the weight that you did, would you want to take a second to do that? Yeah.
I am so sorry for what you are going through. You are worthy of so much more. You are beautiful and you are lovable and you are smart. No matter what has been spoken over you, what is repeated to you, that is told to you, you are enough and you are worthy. And you are deserving of a life that is loving and joy-filled and filled with kindness and care. And I see you doing the best you can, given the circumstances that you have. And you don't have to live that way. And when you're ready, the resources and the community and the people are ready to meet you where you're at. But you do not have to live this way. And there are people that want to help you. And there is possibility. There is a future. There is hope. And I am living proof. Mm-hmm. So I just hope that this will give you seeds that are planted to know that there are resources, there are people, and there is a different way of living. And if I could go back and take my kids out of that situation, I would. The baggage that they carry as adults now is so hard to watch and so hard to bear. But it can all be redeemed. It can all be beautiful no matter what happens. And so I just want you to know that you are loved, that you are beautiful, that you are cared for, that you are enough, and you are worthy of so much more.
Yeah. Thank you. We are going to put your coaching information in the show notes. I can't think of a better endorsement of a business maybe ever than what you just shared in those past couple of minutes. That is what you do with the people you work with, you know. And so if someone did hear that and it did land in a place in them that at some point they would want to work with you, not just to emerge from a situation in a relationship like that, but to really reclaim their life and who they are, where would they find you?
So you can find me on Instagram at Helvic Coaching, and you don't have to follow and you don't have to like, but you will have daily inspiration of me just talking into the camera and sharing how to move from surviving to thriving, because we are badasses. I would add that piece that you are courageous and you have so much spunk and tenacity, resilience, yeah. And that has gotten you so far, and it's going to continue to get you from surviving to thriving. So you can go to Helvet Coaching. I do have a website, helvetcoaching.com. And again, you can DM me or you can just watch the content if that's easier. But there is a way for you to have a free call, just 30 minutes where we get to talk to each other and see if we're a good match. It's a mutual decision, right? So,
yes. Yeah.
Instagram or my website.
Spell it out, will you, just in case people don't.
So Helvic is HELVICK coaching, which is COACHING.com. And that Helvic is an Old Norse word, and it means safe harbor. And that is a place where my dad grew up in Ireland. There was Helvic. So that is where that comes from, is I provide a safe harbor for when you're to help you move from surviving to thriving. And then you can go back out into the big world and conquer and do all the things that you're called to do.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this episode has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, sometimes more than half, and there are many providers who can and want to help. Visit our statewide online resource guide at www.hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area.
Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She's a mom and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful.